really find it a very fulfilling thing to do. One of the things that Joe brought up, though, a couple of things really, before I get started on the 12 locked hearts, is the idea of, they mentioned in the book that we just, the handout, I think it was on page 88, and I didn't bring it up here with me, but it mentions the idea of how maybe people can get hurt, and our ministry is how can we help somebody that's been hurt? We're talking about spiritually, emotionally, and what that might do to a person. In other words, if I was maybe a church member and I even ask a question and then I get an answer, or as Joe made an example of his wife Esther asking, I guess, her dad, you know, and he said, now do it this way. Now, could it be that in that simple action that he basically closed or put a lock on Esther's heart? And then she has a choice to make. Could she say, okay, I'm going to close my heart from the inside because he closed it from the outside? That's kind of, real quickly, the idea of a locked heart, where maybe somebody does or somebody hurts me in a way that it locks my heart, maybe as a very young child, and then I in turn make a choice to say, okay, I've been hurt, I'm going to lock it from the inside. So nobody can get in, nobody can get out. People can't get in to know who I am, and I can't get out to know who other people are because my communication, my emotional, it's all been kind of shut down. Now, we don't go through life like that all the time, but at times when we face situations that are damaging or that could be potentially dangerous, we may tend to resort to these ways of handling things. So we like to examine maybe 12 ways, there's probably more or less, but just ideas of how people lock their hearts down. Now we can say, well, are you sure that this happens in every community? My wife and I didn't know that, but we found everywhere that we go with every people group, no matter if they're from India or from Amish or Catholic or Jewish or wherever, they all have some of the same issues that they're facing in their lives. There is a question, though, and it's amazing to me, really amazing to me, that my wife can sit with me in a room, in an office. We'll have a couple sitting across from us. Could be an Amish couple. And my wife might ask the gentleman a question. Now, I don't know that that's normally acceptable in the community or in the cultural way to say, can I ask a man a question? But my wife will ask the man a question, and he'll actually answer her. And I think that's like a miracle right there that even happens, or that we have the opportunity to even do that. The question, though, is even more telling, because the question might be, is it okay if I lead you in a prayer? This might be a man who's, you know, older than we are, although we're getting a little bit older, a bishop. Can we lead you in a prayer to ask God something? Well, now they're kind of on the spot. But because they've come with maybe a long way to come visit with us, they'll say, okay, yeah, we can do that. Okay, so what's the question? Say, Jesus, do you love me? It's a very simple question. But maybe for the first time in the person's life or in 50 years, if they really sit there and we'll just wait and see, that they say, oh, they might start to cry because they're feeling in their heart that Jesus does love them. Now, that may go against everything they believe, because in their belief system, and maybe, well, I don't really know this, or it's not true, or I can't know maybe till I'm dead if Jesus really loves me or not, because I haven't done everything right, because nobody can do everything right, but I've tried all my life, and I'm going through this huge struggle in my life. People are coming to see us because they have a lot of issues or troubles going on in their life. They desperately want help, but now they felt Jesus says, yes, I do love you, and I accept you for who you are, and that doesn't make any sense. But it starts to break down that wall to get at their heart, because Jesus wants to help them unlock their hearts, but they have a hard time doing that. But we know in Luke 18:27 it says, God is with men, not all things are possible, but with God all things are possible. And so in our office, just about every week, we see God do the impossible. Amen? And that's really amazing. I'd like to start off with a little bit of a discussion about sympathy, because in other words, for the 12 locked hearts is why a person can't show sympathy. Sympathy from the Greek words together and feeling, or syn and pathos, which mean is a perception, understanding, reaction to the distress, to the distress or needs of another human being. This concern is driven by a switch in viewpoint from a person's personal perspective to the perspective of another group or individual who is in need. Usually the first day when a couple comes to meet with us, it's kind of hard for me because I'm somewhat of a sympathetic person, and it really pains me when I see a couple sitting there and there's very little sympathy for each other. A wife may be crying and the husband is looking at her and he's all tensed up in his cheeks, you can see it, and he's kind of holding his teeth really tight and he's really upset. And he's upset because she's crying. He doesn't want her to cry because that means he might be guilty of doing something. So now that's hitting his pride. It's not my fault that she's crying. Well, okay, it may be partly your fault that she's crying, but I'm upset because she's crying and she should stop it. And I don't understand why a person can't be sympathetic towards another person. Why can't we love our neighbor as ourselves? We had this discussion this morning, loving our neighbor. We know that we should love others as ourselves intellectually, but why can't we do this in our hearts? What's causing us to experience a lack of sympathy towards each other that we should have? Is it possible that my heart can be locked against giving and receiving love? What causes a person to experience a lack of love? We found that in working with couples and individuals over the last several years that they've all experienced some kind of spiritual and emotional damage. As a person progresses through life, the pain they've experienced may lead them to make some poor choices. We found that poor choices will always result in more emotional pain. I have to think about the time in John, where there's an example, where Jesus is at telling Peter, what kind of a choice did you make here? Now, he doesn't ask him that question. He says, but do you love these? We think he's referring to maybe fishing. Do you love these more than me? Peter made a choice. Jesus was hung on the cross. He died, and he was gone, and now Peter's made a choice. He's gone, by all respects, he's gone back to fishing. And I think Jesus was saying, in a matter of words, I don't want to, paraphrase here, but Peter, do you love these fish more than me? Now, I granted, if I was a fisherman and Jesus was telling me to feed sheep, that doesn't exactly compute. That's like trying to tell an Amish guy, I want you to become English, maybe. I'm not quite sure on that one. But Jesus was saying, feed my sheep, and he asked Peter again, Jesus, Peter, do you love me? And Peter keeps saying, you know I love you, Jesus, you know I love you. And he says, well, then feed my sheep. Are we willing to feed some of Jesus' sheep? Do we have sympathy in our hearts? Can we have sympathy in our hearts? Is it possible that there's something that's blocking us from doing this? In terms of making choices, we found that choices to escape emotional pain that may be dwelling in our hearts through illegitimate means rather than facing and resolving the pain through legitimate effort and the healing power of the Lord Jesus Christ can only result in one more thing, and that's more emotional pain, not less. There are many, many escapes, and we'll go through some of those escapes here in a moment. But as we know in the world, that they want us to escape in any of a number of ways. We worked with some young couples that have left the Amish, and they have sought escape through every means possible, only to find that their troubles multiplied. Some have become bitter, I know, through some unfortunate circumstances. We had one young Amish man who had left, and he said, I was leaving the community, and I thought I was doing everything right. God wanted me to do that. And I had some money, and I thought I should invest it because I thought, well, now surely God will prosper me because I've left the Amish, which he wanted me to do, and I've lost all that money. Well, what do I just say to him, to a man like that? I have to say, but Jesus still loves you. But he's saying, but I lost all my money. This is not fair. This is not what I asked for when I left the Amish community. I thought God wanted me to do this. Another one mentioned how he was told, if you leave the Amish community, your horse might get hit by lightning and killed. That's going to be your punishment. And you wait and see if it happens. But I'd have to say, well, even if it did happen, is that really God punishing you? Or is that just maybe part of life? It just so happened that lightning hit your horse, although that is extremely rare that lightning would probably do that. But there are things that happen to us in life, circumstances and people that hurt us, and we have to make a choice. Are we going to try and escape through illegitimate means, or are we going to try and resolve them and face that pain? We have to ask everybody that comes into our office that question. We don't ask them exactly that way, but we lead them through a process where they can see what are the choices that I'm actually making. It could be that, yes, some of the choices that they're making, that their parents have told them, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. But we're not telling them that. We're letting them see that for themselves, maybe for the first time. They may have known all along that that's true, and that was right, but for some reason they couldn't see it because their hearts were locked up to it. The truth could be staring them right in the face, but they refused to see it. So what does a locked heart do? A locked heart causes a person to also to damage others in the same way that they've been damaged. The unresolved pain in their heart may feel justified, and that causes them to build up emotional walls of protection to protect themselves from similar hurts or anything or anyone who comes close to touching that pain. The only problem is they may become just like the person that they're bitter against. There's countless people who come in here and say, oh, I don't want to, you know, my dad did this. Not picking on dads, but we've had some stories in there. Maybe my dad used to whip me all the time when I was a boy. He thought that was a way of training me to be a better man. And I never want to do that. But I'm so mad at him that if I had a whip, I'd whip him right now. And unfortunately, his wives and children have been feeling that anger for many years. They can't love another person because of the walls of protection, and they won't allow themselves to give or receive love as God intended. So as mentors and as Christians, our goal should maybe be to help unlock a person's heart, including our own. It probably needs to start here with our own before we can maybe help unlock somebody else's heart, which is the things that, you know, I have to come to grips with. Am I really able to witness to somebody else unless my heart's been cleaned out? We believe, though, that once our hearts are unlocked, we'll be more sympathetic towards another person and be able to more genuinely love our neighbor as ourselves. So today we're going to look at some of the causes, the consequences, and the ways to resolve a locked heart. There are 12 of them. A hostile locked heart, a person who uses anger and hostility but can't show sympathy. We give everybody that comes in our office an analysis, and quite often it shows a level on there of indifference or a lack of sympathy at a very high level, that they don't really love each other. A defiant or rebellious heart, a person that's determined no one will ever tell them what to do again. A neglected locked heart, they've literally been neglected in their life. We had a man come in who said, my mom would put me in a playpen and put me out in the backyard every day while she went to work because I didn't have a father, and I would just have to sit out there in the playpen until she came back home from work. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours later, and then she'd come home. And, of course, he learned at an early age he could cry all he wanted, but it didn't do any good because there was nobody else there to take care of him. When we asked him, where is your heart? What does it look like? He said, I don't know. I can't find it. And after a period of time, he said, I think it's in a metal box, and the box is all sealed up all the way around, and there's no doors or windows on it. His heart was pretty locked up. A self-focused locked heart, a person who focuses on their pain all the time, and they can't recognize somebody else's pain. A rejected locked heart, a person driven to please others to gain their acceptance. They'll almost do anything for attention. Maybe we know somebody like that. I'm sure we know everybody knows somebody that has one or more of all of these. Usually people have two or three types of locks going on in their hearts at any time. A moral locked heart, a person who cannot love their spouse. An intellectual locked heart. Now, this may sound like I like that only because maybe that means I'm really smart and that's why I'm intellectually locked. But that really means that I can't really maybe love from my heart at all because I have to process everything objectively. And somebody could be hurt very bad, and I would just look, maybe if I was intellectually locked, look at it and say, well, gee, that's too bad. Hope they get better. What's for dinner? I'm really not very sympathetic at all. A defiled locked heart, a person will not let anybody into their heart. because they've been hurt too severely. These people that have been defiled are extremely fragile people because somebody's damaged them very, very badly. A dominant locked heart. A person who has to be in control of the situation and in charge of all those around him all the time. They feel threatened by people all the time if they feel as though they're not going to be able to be in control, even if it's something as simple as, you know, I'm going to put the dishes in the dishwasher left to right instead of right to left, and they want it done left to right. Does it make sense? But they want it done their way, and it has to be done that way. A driven locked heart, a person who is continually driving themselves and is never happy. They can't relax. They can't accept things. They can't feel things. A spiritual locked heart, a person who cannot feel Jesus loves them. This is always a difficult one because if a person has a spiritual locked heart and they don't know that Jesus loves them, then who do they have to turn to? Which is probably what a lot of people, if I came out of the Amish and I've been told, God does not love you anymore, and I have troubles because in our life it is filled with trials and tribulations. Things are going to happen. I have nowhere to turn. If I turn to my wife, she can't possibly have all the answers for me. I only have myself, and if I can't come to grips with what's going on, I can't go to God. I have nobody left except nobody. I could get maybe very depressed and maybe even suicidal. An enemy-controlled locked heart, a person who's given territory in their heart to the enemy in such a way that the enemy has the ability to influence their heart. We've seen some of this as typically maybe a person who's a drug addict and has really lived an immoral lifestyle, and they've been given over to the enemy to the point where the enemy is controlling their heart. This is
Albert and Cindy's testimony. We've been married almost 17 years. Our marriage could be described as a wild roller coaster ride, way up 1 minute and hitting bottom for the next few hours. So this is how we existed for most of our life together. Albert's outburst of extreme anger and my slow descent into deep depression. Both of us coming from abusive homes, his much more so than mine. Our backgrounds are, we both grew up Old Order Amish. About 7 years ago, we became born-again believers and left the Amish culture. It was somewhat of a culture shock for us. For me and the children, it was dress-wise, but for Albert, it was more work-related shock. 1.5 year after we left that way of life, things started to spiral down. Albert got more entangled with bitterness, anger, negative thinking, and moral failure. He became very angry with God because for the next 6 years, things slowly were taken away. Jobs were always just out of reach. Then we had to sell things to make our payments, which made Albert more and more bitter. We finally saw that our home in Ohio had to be sold. So we did pray about that and put our place on the market and started looking for a new place to call home. We felt we should move to Tennessee, so we started looking and nothing opened up right away. Our house sold after only a few short months on the market, but we still had no place to call home. At the very last minute, a home came up for rent in Tennessee that fit our family of seven. We have lived in Tennessee for almost 2 years now and love it. But things on the home front took a turn for the worse, much worse. Albert started to drink to forget his troubles, meanwhile threatening to leave me if things didn't start to go better. One night, after drinking heavily, we got into an argument about everything that was going wrong. Albert got violent that night and hit me. That's when I realized I needed desperately to find help. If not, I and our children might be badly hurt. So I called a friend and her husband came over to talk to Albert. I also called Joe Kime. Joe told me that he will find help for us. So about a week later, Joe called back saying he'd found a couple in Michigan who had an opening in February, if we'd be willing to go. We had no funds to go, but Joe told us not to worry about the money, that God will supply. God did supply all the funds needed through people that had no clue who we even were. Before going, I had great fear because I wasn't sure if this couple could help my husband. His heart was so mad and bitter, it looked impossible. On February 7th, we met Charles and Diane for the first time. We were introduced to Healing of the Heart Ministries. Monday, we was just about getting to know each other, telling our story to them, and basically becoming comfortable with each other. Tuesday was, like Charles put it, them looking for potatoes or clues. And we did have our work cut out as well, watching teaching CDs on lots of different things, shedding light on many hidden sins and strongholds. Tuesday night, my husband was in great despair. He said, "This will never work," and decided to leave me at the hotel and go home by himself. I pleaded with him to give it some time and that I would help him all I could to get through the lesson. By the way, was on bitterness. He stayed. I called Diane, and they were so compassionate with us. The next day, we started to pray through some of these strongholds in our life. By Thursday, layer after layer of hurt, anger, bitterness, hypocrisy, and pain were being shed. I can tell, as each day ended, Albert's eyes got a little brighter. Thursday, we spent all day with Charles and Diane. We covered a lot of ground. The one thing that was so clear in our mind was Albert and I had so much hidden sin in our lives. Yet we felt love pour out of these two people that just days earlier had not known us, and also, God met us there right where we were. All we had to do was bring a willing heart, wanting things to change. Friday came, and that morning fear set in a little. Albert was afraid God still had something against him, so we set off for Charles and Diane's office, not knowing what the day had in store. Were we in for a surprise? As Albert and I prayed through the last layers of strongholds, God met us in a big way, confirming that our hearts were clean and we were indeed set free from all defilement. What joy we felt as we thanked Charles and Diane's heading home. As we strive to live each day in freedom, trusting God for our needs, we now have the tools needed to fight against sin and strongholds, to stay free. We will still face trials in this life, but we know without the shadow of a doubt that God cares deeply about our hurts and needs, be they great or small. Praise his holy name. Sincerely, Albert and Cindy Miller.
Sorry I didn't introduce that. I kind of had it planned, but and we also have another testimony that we're going to show in a couple minutes. But that's just an idea of the kind of things that we face in our office. And one of the other things I was going to say when Joe asked us if we'd be willing to help. Of course, we didn't really know what we were going to get into. But one of the things that really I have to keep in mind is I should not be like arrogant enough to think that I really can understand the pain that these folks are going through. I never lost a family member, you know, or was abandoned as a child. I mean, there was hurts and things that I had in a different way, but I really have to respect them. I have advanced degrees, but I am always amazed at how most Amish people that I've met, I mean, they might leave the Amish with $5, and 2 years later they have their own businesses going. They're very resourceful, and we always have to chuckle that that they always seem to be more advanced technologically than we are. As I was kidding earlier, my cell phone still has a dial on it, and so we always have to really think, okay, there's differences with us, but we really can't look down on anybody else. A hostile, locked heart. A person with a hostile, locked heart is able to get angry but show little sympathy. We found causes to be unresolved bitterness that's been kept inside for a very long period of time. Emotional pain that's never been resolved but suppressed and dealt with by the use of anger and defiance. So whenever they're faced with any kind of emotional pressure, they'll usually just get angry about it, and they shut down. Whenever a person tries to get close to them emotionally, they attack. And that's what Cindy found out when she would try and get close to Albert, that things would just get worse, not better. They turn hostility, anger, and unresolved bitterness from one person to another. Their spouse may typically only know their anger, and their children feel unloved. If we ask them, when did you notice this happening, many times they'll say, well, right after we got married. Maybe the person was able to control their anger while they're dating, but then after they got married, it started to come out right away. People may want to get away from them as quickly as possible, and you can understand maybe why that would be, because of another person's anger. And their children may want to move away as soon as they can. They might say, a child might say, hey, as soon as I'm 18 years old or whenever I can, I'm out of here, because I can't stand the anger. The spouse may want to try and seek ways to keep peace in the home. The problem is she may want to do it at peace at any cost. That further will limit the ability of any healthy relationships. So if a wife says, okay, children, we have to, don't get dad angry and upset, but they're going to get shut down emotionally as well because of what's going on in the house. They know it's not right, and this is really not the way to respond, and dad should not be angry, but everybody's afraid to do anything about it. A person like that may find themselves very alone in their life. A defiant or rebellious Lockhart. A person with a defiant or rebellious Lockhart is determined to do whatever they want to do, and nobody else is going to tell them anything. They'll seek ways to avoid doing what they're asked to do and defy anyone who controls them, even with its sound advice. So even though my wife may have given me sound advice, if I'm rebellious, I'm not going to listen to that advice because I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. We find that there's two types of rebellion, inward and outward. Inward might be worse than the outward. The outward is right in your face and you know that there's an issue. And maybe you can address it, but the inward one hangs on to it. And then suddenly this child who you thought maybe was doing everything really, was your good child, all of a sudden now they're acting really strange. What is going on here? Because they are harboring rebellion in their hearts for many years. Some of the causes that we've seen are maybe a child of a parent who's extremely dominant and controlling, or critical and judgmental. They may have attitudes of defiance or rebellion passed on generationally. Bitterness, the result of a hurt caused by a person in authority over them, may cause a person to put up a wall. An individual's rebellion can be influenced by the enemy. An individual who's been sexually abused can be very hostile and dominant. Joe mentioned that in the book, I think it was on page 80, I'm not sure if that's the exact page, that now these types of things are showing up in the Amish society, maybe as never before. And a person that's been sexually abused, there's two things that's going on. Not only have they been hurt, but many times they feel guilty. They feel like they were responsible that they were abused. And that's not right, because now they're living with guilt that they've sinned and it wasn't their, and there's nothing they can do about it to fix that with God. So if my belief is that I have to do things right or I have to fix things so I can get to God, how can I get there if I was abused and I'm guilty? And really, it wasn't my fault, but I was told it was my fault. So now I'm really confused. So to try and keep from getting hurt anymore in my life, I will be dominant and hostile to anybody that even comes close to trying and controlling me. An individual that's been abused spiritually may become defiant against God, pastors, churches, or a spouse that's a believer. That's why it's really amazing to us. We see two types of maybe people that come out of the Amish. One is the person who's had a new relationship with Christ. The other is maybe somebody that's just rebelling against the rules and authority. And then they come out and they really don't, they are against the church. They're against God. They're not open to any type of church at all, and that's really a shame that that's happened. What are the consequences of a defiant or rebellious Lockhart? A person can turn their rebellion from one person to another, such as a newly married spouse who may be totally unsuspecting that this is going to happen. It makes for a difficult marriage, as you can probably imagine, if your spouse reacts and refuses to anything you suggest, no matter how logical or profitable or how simple a task it may be. A person that's like this can't give or receive love, and they're extremely frustrating to other people because they can't agree on anything unless they feel that they are in control. A neglected Lockhart. A person like this can't trust. I mean, if you were a child and your parent said, if you said, Mommy, is that stove hot? And you said, oh yeah, put your hand on it, knowing that it was going to burn her hand, that child's going to have a hard time trusting. A neglected person with a neglected Lockhart has been abused pretty badly in many different ways. If a couple is divorced and the child says, Daddy, can I see you Saturday? Well, are you going to come over? And he says, oh, sure, I'll come over. And then he doesn't come over. And then it's repeated, and then she never sees Dad again. Her little heart is all locked up because she's been neglected by Dad. He doesn't care. What are the consequences of a neglected Lockhart? A spouse may try to love them, but they can never allow themselves to feel loved until Jesus, helps to resolve the pain in their heart. So we get a couple that gets married, and the guy thinks, oh, my wife, I'm in love with her, she's in love with me, but she has this inside, this neglected little heart. She wants her husband to love her, but she really can't let him in because she's afraid to, because she's afraid she's going to get hurt, like when she was a little girl. And if he even, some night he comes home late from work, 2 hours late, and she's all upset. And he doesn't have any what's the matter? I mean, I just was late from work. What's the big deal? I don't understand this. But she's thinking maybe he was never going to come home because daddy never came back. A self-focused, locked heart. They may focus on how they can get their spouse to meet their needs. Now, we always like to try and meet somebody else's, a person's needs if I love this person. The problem with a self-focused person is no matter how hard I might try as a spouse, they may never feel as though their needs are being met. And that's going to emotionally drain another person that might be married to somebody like this. This person needs to get help for their pain with Christ. Examples of that might be an alcoholic person who only focuses on their pain all the time, and they're looking for the next place or time that they can get a drink. And if they come in the house and they say, hey, Dad, I've got a problem, I don't want to hear it. Where's a drink? I'm going to get a drink. I can't take this. So the child never really gets anything from the parent. Unfortunately, sometimes the children, they learn from mom and dad. So they may become self-focused as well. They might not become alcoholics, but they may respond in a self-focused manner. Pride can cause a type of self-focus known as hidden pride. A person with hidden pride focuses on themselves. Maybe they feel that they are right, and they have to be right all the time. They can't give love because their focus is not on another person who may be trying to give them love. Their focus is on me, and is somebody touching my pride or trying to hurt me all the time. They can't connect with their spouse because they're not able to see their spouse's needs. Very low sympathy, if any. We had a couple who the wife miscarried at home, and the husband cleaned up things and said, well, I took care of everything. But he didn't know how to emotionally connect with his wife and didn't understand what she was going through, her pain. He was a little bit too self-focused on his pain. They can't show love to their spouse since they only love themselves. The marriage cannot be fulfilling because it is self-centered. A moral locked heart. With the rise of all the access to things like the internet and smartphones and television and cable and all the various ways of things getting at, we see a lot of people that are what we're going to consider sexual addicts in our office. I think my wife was commenting in this past year that we saw more of that than just about anything. And we don't know where it is going to end or if there's anything under control. We do know that parents, though, are out there handing their child who's 7 or 8 or 9 years old a smartphone. Now, I don't know that that's really the smartest thing to do, and it's kind of, pardon the pun, but most English, if I handed an 8-year-old child a fully loaded automatic weapon, would probably not think that that's such a smart idea. Or if I handed them, say, get the keys of the car, okay, go ahead and drive the car down the street, no problem. Well, no, I wouldn't do that because a child's 7 or 8 years old. But this is precisely what they're doing with these phones that have full internet access with no blockers on them at all. Well, the child maybe is innocent, doesn't know what they're looking at, but they're looking at all kinds of stuff, and they have no idea what the stuff is about. But kids are pretty smart, and they start to figure out things pretty quickly. And I think that, unfortunately, we're going to see more and more of this unless parents start to take the right steps and realize the danger of some of these things. A moral locked heart. A person with a moral locked heart cannot love their spouse. It's impossible to be attached to immorality and focus on the emotional needs of your spouse. It just doesn't work. One of the things that we really try to emphasize with a couple is emotional attachment. And many times when they come with us, they'll say, oh yeah, okay, but they really don't have any idea what we're talking about when we say emotional attachment. We say, when did your trouble in your marriage start? Well, it started, I think about the A month after we got married, we just were arguing and fighting all the time, and we couldn't agree on anything, and we were just having a terrible time. Okay? Well, do you remember any time earlier than that? Well, yeah, there was a time earlier than that. We had some fights, and before we even got married. Did you have premarital relationships before you got married sexually? Yes, we would talk to each other, and we really got to love each other, and then we knew we were going to get married, so we started having a physical attraction, and then we might ask the question, well, at that point, do you think that the emotional attachment kind of started to suffer? And the wife might say, yeah, I know, that's when it kind of died. So we might say to couples, or to parents even, do you know of a couple or a son or a daughter who's dating right now? Are they going through a lot of arguments and where they break up and then get back together and they break up and get back together? Is there something else going on there that they're not talking about? But we believe that an emotional attachment can be reestablished. Our goal is to clean all these things up. When people come into our office, I might kid them about the idea of we're going to overturn every rock. In fact, we want you to check your rocks at the door because we don't want you throwing them at each other anymore. But unfortunately, that doesn't always work because we might ask a question and then they might look at each other and then we start to see the rocks start to come back, the proverbial rocks, they start to come out, and we have to work with them a little bit longer. Some indications that a person may be immoral is that a man in immorality may use flattering statements with other women, causing tremendous damage to his wife's heart. I've literally sat in the office and said, so your wife says every time you walk in a restaurant, you have to basically flirt with every waitress in the restaurant. No, that's not true. I just talk to them and I'm just friendly. Okay. They may smirk and try and cover their guilt. And typically maybe they can wine and dine people because they're shrewd. They want to get people to think I'm a good guy, that I'm really not this evil person. My wife's, oh, by the way, she's crazy. I've heard that over and over and over and over and over again. A guy will come in and say, you know, my wife's crazy. She just thinks I'm crazy. She thinks I'm a sex maniac. She's just nuts. I'm like, okay, really? Is that true? Tell me. What's going on here? But he can't really tell me the truth because if he did, then he'd be guilty and he doesn't want to go there. So I'll get some long response about how his wife is being deceived by the enemy or something else when really he's the one that's being deceived. And you say, well, how do we even have any clue that maybe this is going on? Well, again, we have to take an analysis. And the analysis might come back and say, wow, look, this husband's only loving his wife at a 1% level. So that means 99% of the time he's not loving her at all. And she's wondering why she's feeling unloved. Okay, if she's not feeling loved and he's really not loving her, really doesn't care about her, and the only reason he's here is because she dragged him in here. Okay, what's really going on? Now, we can't just ask what's really going on. Sometimes I might have to be a little bit more forceful with a guy and almost say, you know, can you just tell me what's really going on? Most of the time, they'll realize it for themselves and say, I need to talk to you about what's really going on. But I don't want my wife to know because once she finds out, you know, that's going to be a big problem. It's, well, we're going to work on that. It'll be okay. Same thing, though, is for a wife who's maybe addicted to fantasy or lust. With all these things that are available now, we're seeing, unfortunately, women that are starting to get drawn into these things as well. What are the causes of a moral locked heart? Many times we find if we ask a person, I got into pornography when I was 8 years old. Okay, where did that come from? Well, it was sitting around the house. I don't know. Or my brother showed it to me. Or my cousins or somebody. We get a lot of people to talk about cousins. I don't understand what it is, but there seems to be a lot of people that have been abused or shown things that they shouldn't have been by cousins. Just as a little bit of a warning, maybe. Not that every cousin's going to do something, but we have had more than several instances where cousins have done things to other cousins. Being sexually abused, many times a person will say, yes, they were abused at a young age, and because of that guilt that put pain in their heart, they didn't know what to do with that pain. And so a way to resolve that pain is to try and escape that pain. And the way they escape that pain is through whatever means they can get a hold of at the time. And if they were maybe rebellious, maybe their parent would discipline them for being rebellious. So, okay, I can't use that escape. So how am I going to try and escape this pain? Maybe they'll get into pornography or some type of lust at an early age to try and escape that pain, and it just keeps going on through life. Or maybe they were involved in immoral relationships before or during or marriage that have been going on for a long time. What are the consequences of a moral locked heart? We're saying that a person with a moral locked heart, they can do things for people, they can serve them, but they can never really love them. And their spouse will say, you know, like, my husband takes care of me, he's a good provider, but I have never really felt loved by him, and I can't quite figure it out. There's something missing. And there's a saying in our office, if there's something that's missing, then there's something missing. We're not going to believe that there's nothing missing, that there is a piece to this puzzle that we're not seeing, and we need to have God help uncover what's going on. Immorality can lead to many other things. We may show this chart to a couple and say, well, have you seen any of this in your life after they've admitted immorality, or maybe before they're thinking about it, any of these causes? Have you seen this in your own life? Well, yeah, we know that we've lied to each other, and we've had huge financial losses. Then we have to try and cover things up. We have conflict in the family all the time. We don't really like each other. We don't want to be together anymore. Pastors, certainly, if they get involved in these things, their entire flock's going to be impacted by the idea of what happened in their church if this came out. Your children may never see you as an honest person, but as a hypocrite if you say one thing and do something else. You may open the door for the enemy to attack your spouse and children, closing their hearts in a relationship. During several years, we've been meeting with couples. We've only met a few that were not involved premaritally. And typically that results in a lack of intimacy in a marriage. Well, how does that work? Well, most of the time, women would like an emotional relationship with the guy. They don't want to just feel used. Maybe a woman can't respond as her husband would like. We've had some men who say that the only way they can respond is by doing some things that aren't what I'll call normal. Then there's a loss of communication. Many people come to say, I can't communicate, my wife and I don't communicate anymore. Well, that's not true. They're communicating, only their communication is not resolving any of the issues. So they distrust each other. They have a lack of respect. They have a lack of sympathy. There's rejection going on. Conflict, blame, and guilt. This is a video now of another couple I'd like you to see. They came to see us in our office and actually now serves on our board.
Albert and
this was David and Elisa.
Well, I'm just so thankful for what Healing of the Heart Ministry here with Chuck and Diane have done for us. When I tell people about what the week was for me, I describe it as kind of open heart surgery, and that sounds terrible, and to a certain degree it is, but it was really just a wonderful cleansing process for me. And I learned that our hearts can be locked up in a variety of ways. It can be from pain, an injury of the past. It can be from strongholds that you've let the devil set up in your own heart that that put you into bondage, really. And for me, my wound occurred very early in my life. When I was 5 years old, there was a tractor accident which killed my brother. I'm sorry, I was six, he was 5 years old. And I was there on the tractor. We were riding on the fenders and pulling a bush hog behind. The driver was pulling a bush hog. He fell off and ended up rolling under the bush hog, and it killed him. And I really blamed myself for that. I was riding across from him. I thought, well, I should have reached out and grabbed him and didn't do that. That really, I think, and even though I received some counseling at the time as a child, I held some guilt because of that, and that gave me really an overactive sense of responsibility, feeling like it was my job to help others, even if it wasn't really my job to help others. That was a responsibility that I put on myself, and also just left an emptiness inside that made me feel, I guess, like a failure to some degree. You know, God can use bad things in our past to make good come about. Well, the enemy can take seemingly good things and turn those against us as well. And so that that sense of responsibility I had, which could be a good thing, I think the enemy used to trap me in some ways. I tried to fill that emptiness with other things that were not of God, and the enemy was able to set up strongholds. I had an impure thought life for a long time, which I even went to elders and church leaders at some points when I was a young man and asked for help with, and no one really took it seriously or followed up. They gave me some, you know, advice that wasn't always helpful, like, well, that'll get easier as you get older, or just don't seek it out. Well, it doesn't get easier as you get older, there are images all around us that are not helpful. And so that led to eventually what became an affair and a moral failure. And that even prior to that, though, I always had a hard time really sharing myself with others, opening up, because I had built this wall around my heart and wasn't able to share that with others. And certainly wasn't able to share with Elisa. And so we lacked intimacy in our relationship that I was, you know, felt like I had that desire to have an intimacy, but just never could get there. And so Chuck and Diane, really in this open heart surgery time, allowed us to really get to know ourselves and our own stories. Mm-hmm. And how things in our past had impacted us. And then not only did we just learn about our stories, but we were able to, they led us to Jesus to clean up things that needed to be cleaned up, and then also to heal the broken parts that were there. Because without that piece, I think that was really the key piece, taking us to Jesus and through Christ and the Holy Spirit, allowing healing to take place in those hurt places. That's where the true freedom comes from. And I'm so excited that happened for us, and that we were able to reestablish a relationship and make it even better than it had ever been before, and even better than what we had ever dreamed that it could be, at least that I could dream that it could be. And we're excited that they're doing this for many couples all the time. And we certainly continue to support them and pray for them constantly as they do this for others.
Like David, healing of the heart has meant so much to us, and what it has done for us is life-changing. Our whole trajectory has really changed in such a way that I can only give God the credit and thank Charles and Diane for all that they have done since we met with them a few years ago, and continue to do for us. They have become good friends and mentors to us in ways that we're so richly blessed. It's been amazing. Several years back, even before we had our crisis, I just really began a search, was reading in my Bible from Psalm 37, and it says, "Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will do this. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently." In addition to that, I was also reading at the same time in Proverbs, it says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight." I began to think about that and realized I had no clue what all my heart was, or what giving him my whole heart even meant. And so I began to pray, knowing that God would be faithful and give me those answers. And it began to, I'm quite confident that God began to move in our lives in a way that I had no clue. And it was a painful path, but God worked through that. And truly, in healing of the heart, with the counseling that we received, we began to see what our whole hearts were and how our hearts had been damaged and hurt in so many ways that we didn't even know. So often we go through life just really feeling like we're stuck or it's just the way it is, and that we just have to settle. It's not going to change, so we might as well just deal with it. And God never intended for us to live that way. He desired and still desires for us to live abundant, rich lives. John 10:10 says that the enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And he is on that path constantly trying to destroy us. And so he takes the things in our hurt, in our lives, and compounds them. Like David said, sometimes it's good things, and sometimes it's hurts and pains in our lives. And I had a wonderful family, but I also, I had two older brothers, and what most people would consider brotherly love, sibling rivalry, well, it was not that for me. It was emotional abuse. It was painful, and it cut my heart in such a way that alongside some sexual abuse, just it broke my heart. And I remember very clearly saying, nobody's going to ever hurt me like that again. And so I put up a wall, and I didn't know that I had put up a wall, but that was also the beginning of when the enemy could get in and just use me for his purposes, and I didn't even know it. And so through the counseling that we have received, God has healed those places in our lives and in my life in such a way that I can love David and I can be loved by him. And I'm just so, so grateful, because I have a life that I wouldn't trade for anything. And David's choices obviously impacted me very greatly, but now we have a marriage, a real marriage, that is so so much better than anything I could have ever imagined. And so I just really am so, so grateful to God for using Charles and Diane in the ministry of healing of the heart. And one thing that I guess I would like to close with that has been such a huge blessing to me is a scripture in Isaiah 43, and it says, "Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing, and it springs up. Don't you perceive it? I am making a way in the desert and streams in the wasteland to give drink to my people, my chosen, the people I formed for myself, that they may proclaim my praise." I give him all the glory and the praise because of what he has done.
Time's just about up. I know we were going to talk about ways to resolve a locked heart. One of the things we really appreciate about most of the couples, especially people that were or are or were Amish, is that they seem to be very willing to try and do whatever it takes to try and resolve the issues in their life. They don't give up very easily. But one of the way we work is to work through issues of pride and abuse and bitterness and rebellion and a cult or ground given to the enemy, a moral failure and hypocrisy and temporal values and negative thoughts. And people were sitting there saying, "I don't understand this. Why do I have to go through negative thoughts? Why do I have to go through temporal values? Don't you understand? My wife and I aren't getting along." And say, yes, we do understand that. That's why we need to go through all these issues. In this book, this workbook that we have, because we want you to start giving up some of these things. so that you can start to talk to each other again, so you can learn to really truly love each other again. Because as long as you're hanging on to all this stuff, you're never going to get anywhere. It's pretty simple. You say you need to forgive people. I don't have any bitterness in my life. Okay. I don't have any. Well, can you say I forgive? Well, I really can't. Can you say I was wrong? No, I can't say that. Well, okay, we have to start there. Can I learn to say maybe I was wrong for something that I did, and I choose to forgive this person? Even if they don't forgive me, I choose to forgive them. And I might ask a husband, how long are you willing to wait before your wife feels like it's safe again? Are you willing to wait forever? Well, I don't know if I'm going to wait that long. So, well, now, what are you saying to her? If you're not willing to wait forever, she wants to hear that you're willing to wait forever for her, because you're her Prince Charming. You're the little girl that she wants to be chased by. I mean, you're the little boy that wants to chase the little girl. And it's kind of funny when every woman that we've ever asked in our office, do you like to be chased by that little boy? And they get this little smile on their face, and they're like, oh, yeah, that sounds like fun. But they can't remember when they felt that way for a very long, long time, and their hearts are just kind of crushed and broken. Now, I know I kind of picked on the guys here today a lot. I hope you forgive me for that, because it does go both ways. When couples call us up, they are maybe all convinced that it's the other person's fault, but we know there's always two sides to the story. And I'll just be ending with this, the idea of, I had a man call me up several years ago, and he said, a man called me. Occasionally, yes, men do call us. It's not always the wife that calls. It says, I need help for my marriage, but my wife will never come in. And I say, oh, she won't come in? No, she'll never come in. I said, okay. Well, maybe we can pray about that. And he goes, you don't understand. She's never going to come in. I said, well, she's alive. Yes, but she's never going to come in. I said, okay. So I took out my little mustard seed, which is pretty tiny. And I said, okay, let's pray. Sometimes we say that if we don't know what to do. But anyhow, I said, okay, let's pray, and we'll wait and see what happens. So he called me back about a month later. I said, okay, anything changed? Nope, she's never going to come in. I said, okay, let's keep praying. He said, okay, you can pray. So I prayed for him. Okay, Lord, we asked that, you know, his wife will agree to come in one of these days, and you'll make a way for that to happen. One day, she called up, talked to my wife on the telephone. My wife hung up the phone. She says, oh, she said she's going to come in. 2 minutes later, our phone rings again. It's this man saying, hi, it's me again. My wife's not going to come in. I said, are you at home? He goes, yeah. I said, are you talking real loud? He goes, why? I said, because your wife just called us and said she's willing to come in. So please don't say she's not going to come in, because she already agreed to do it. If she hears you saying she's never going to come in, she's not going to come in. So please. But they did come in. It took them a while. It took more than one counseling session. It took several. But eventually, they are still together to this day. And we're thankful for God for that, because we know that with men, things are impossible, but with God, all things are possible. And we thank him for that, and for him reminding us of that every day. Amen.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, we're going to break for supper. And at 6 o'clock, you're welcome to come back for Stefan Schmidt and family and First Love for a concert at 6. And Jonas, you want to ask the blessing on the meal? Let's rise, stand together.